All right, open your Bibles to Acts chapter 18, please. 18th chapter of Acts. And we'll cover the first 11 verses, and then we'll pause in the narrative, as I announced this past Sunday. And we'll spend the rest of the time in class tonight quickly and briefly surveying the Thessalonian letters and whatever we get, however far we get, whether it's in the first letter or the second letter, then we'll end class and we'll pick that up Sunday morning and then come back to Acts 18 and finish through verse 22 as our curriculum has us going to. All right. Let's begin with our Acts facts. We do add a new one tonight, the 18th chapter. Do you feel like these are helping? A little? Just memory aids to help you just remember what the basic content of the chapter is. That's its purpose. Nothing other than that. All right, chapter 1. Ascension and appointment. Chapter 2. Pentecost and Peter's preaching. Chapter 3. The lame man that they healed. And the second sermon, Peter's lesson. Lame man and lesson. Chapter 4. Restraint, release, and request. The two apostles jailed and then they were released. That would be Peter and John. Chapter 5, deception and detention. Ananias and Sapphira's attempt to deceive the believers, and the Holy Spirit took care of that. All the apostles detained, chapter 5. Chapter 6, the servants, seven selected. Chapter 7, Stephen was stoned. Chapter 8, Samaria. The gospel finally went outside Jerusalem, went to Samaria, and the Samaritans were saved, even Simon the sorcerer. A lot of S's in there. Chapter 9. Saul saved and Dorcas raised from the dead or delivered. Chapter 10. Cornelius converted. Chapter 11. You've kind of waned. Chapter 11. I heard it. Report and relief. Peter had to give the report because the Jews took him to task in chapter 10 for going into the Gentiles. So he had to give a report, and then they sent relief to the Christians in Judea. Chapter 12, persecution, Peter, and pride. Peter was jailed, and Herod had James killed, and then he was going to execute Peter as well, and then he died. Herod died because of his pride at the end of the chapter. Here are the two non-alliterative statements, 13 and 14. What's 13? Antioch to Iconium. The first journey began. Then chapter 14 is a reverse. Back to Antioch. Iconium to Antioch. Chapter 15. Disagreement and decision. When they had the conference, what we've called the conference in Jerusalem over circumcision. And they decided how to let the Gentiles be informed of what had come out of that. Chapter 16. The Philippian prison. When Paul went to Philippi, saved converted Lydia, but mainly the story is the jailer in Philippi. Chapter 17, addressing Athens. We studied that last class when Paul gave his sermon. And chapter 18 is three more A's. It would be Achaia, which is where we are. Then the journey ends in Antioch. And then Apollos. We talk about Apollos at the end of chapter 18. So really we're just in Achaia tonight. We're not going to get to Antioch or Apollos just yet. So we're plowing right through those. Very, very good. You're doing great. All right, so Paul arrives in Corinth. This is the first four verses of chapter 18 of Acts. And he leaves Athens as the chapter 17 concluded. Now remember, he's still alone. That was a really bad mark right there. He's still alone. He has not been visited yet by Silas and Timothy. That won't happen until verse 5. They haven't come to him yet, so he's still there. And he meets two other people, though. Who does Luke mention for the first time? All right, Aquila or Aquila. Aquila and Priscilla. Why were they in Corinth? They had been, with other Jews, they had been expelled or kicked out of Rome by Claudius. Waldron's speak a little bit about the date. They don't seem too convinced in their book that it was AD 49. Other writers do if you do any reading, but we'll just leave that unknown. It's not really germane to our discussion. So they are there with other Jews again, as I just said. And They were disciples either already or Paul converted them. We don't know which way that goes. And just make this point, when Luke does mention someone who's already a disciple, like Timothy in chapter 16, he says a certain disciple named Timothy. So he doesn't call them disciples here. Maybe they were. Maybe Paul converted them. We don't know. But at any rate, whether they were already Christians or not, what do we know about this couple from other passages? They were a great help to the early church, especially Romans 16 and 1 Corinthians 16. They hosted churches in their homes. They were people, you know, house churches were prevalent in the first century. And they were ones who opened their home to brethren. So they would, and Paul spoke very highly of them as he concluded those letters because of the work they did for the gospel or the kingdom. And it seems that these three, Paul, Aquila, and Priscilla, struck an immediate bond. What was it that brought them together? Yeah, they shared a secular interest. They made tents. So perhaps that's where Paul met them, wherever the tent-making operations were going on in Corinth, certain part of the market or some side street in Corinth, wherever it was. Maybe that's how they met and they began talking, and maybe through those conversations, that's how Paul converted them. Again, maybe they were already disciples. Be it as it may, they developed a close bond, and they were not just were more importantly, they of course were brethren. Eventually, that becomes the case. So he meets and befriends them, and then this concludes there in verse 4. Again, what is Paul's custom when he gets to a new city? He goes to the synagogue, try to reason with the Jews. And Luke writes here, he was trying to persuade both Jews and Greeks, not just Jews. Of course, he would use the prophets to talk to the Jews, obviously, and the Greeks, if they knew, if maybe these were Greeks who worshipped at the synagogue. They were maybe somewhat familiar with the prophets as well. Anyway, Paul was trying his best to persuade them to come to Christ and obey the gospel. So that's his arrival and some of his very early work in Corinth. Now, verses 5 through 11, at this juncture, the story takes a turn. It shifts, if you will. And who finally arrives in Corinth? Well, it's Silas and Timothy. They finally get there. Now, Timothy, definitely from Thessalonica, because we have that phrase in 1 Thessalonians 3, verses 1 through 2 and verse 5. We mentioned that this past Sunday. And again, I think the Walters make a pretty strong case in their book that they seem to indicate that Silas possibly, probably, likely went to Berea. So however it played itself out, Luke just says that Silas and Timothy came down from Macedonia. Those would have been two Macedonian cities, obviously. So they finally arrive to Paul. Now, they had come back to Paul when he was in Athens, because he writes again in this passage here, he thought it'd be best to be left alone. So they left. And this is where we think they went to Thessalonica and to Berea. So now they've come back to Paul. He's in Corinth. And they also, of course, they bring a good report to Paul. But to do something else, and this is my favorite part of the study of Acts, is when you get to work in the epistles. Little nuggets of truth here and there, it kind of completes the story. Hold your place here in Acts. Turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 11. And there's a statement there that certainly comes into play here. When Paul's writing the church, of course he's in Corinth, so he's writing the Corinthian church. And he says in verse 7, 2 Corinthians 11, he says, "Did I commit sin in abasing myself that you might be exalted, because I preached the gospel of God to you free of charge?" So Paul did not receive support when he labored in Corinth, and that's his point. Verse 8, "I robbed other churches, taking wages from them to minister to you." Now here's the point in verse 9. "When I was present with you and in need, I was a burden to no one." And how did he have his supplies met or his needs met? What's he saying, verse 9? "When the brethren who came from Macedonia, they supplied what I..." Well, who's the brethren he's mentioning? Move to Silas and Timothy. When they came down from Macedonia. So Timothy brought support from Thessalonica. Maybe Silas brought support from Berea. So Paul mentions that. And as a result, look in verse 5. Now the New King James, this back in Acts 18, the New King James is worded just a little bit differently. And I don't have an answer as to why that it is. But at this juncture, I prefer the New American Standard because I think it makes a pretty good case for the point we're making here. New King James reads, "When Silas and Timothy had come from Macedonia, Paul was constrained by the Spirit." Other versions read this way, "Paul began devoting himself completely to the Word." And I'm saying I believe this is the better translation because of this passage right here. When they brought support to Paul in Corinth from Macedonia, Paul could devote himself. He could stop making tents. Oh, there's nothing wrong with that, but he could stop doing that and devote his time completely and fully to preaching the gospel. I heard Bill Hall one time say, at this juncture, Paul went full time. He began preaching only. And this phrase in the New Testament Greek means to be held by or closely occupied with in teaching the Word. And that seems to support this translation. So Paul could devote himself completely, totally, 100% to preaching the gospel. And so that's why I believe that's a good translation. So they get to Corinth, and that's what they bring Paul. A good report. Brethren are doing great. And here's support, here's financial support for you to devote yourself fully to the gospel. So let's bring up a map again, just to, again, sort of review. Where is Paul? Right now? He's in Corinth, okay? And so, Silas and Timothy have come down from Macedonia. Timothy came from Thessalonica. So Timothy comes down here. Silas, we think, came from Berea. So Silas is there. So they come and they bring a report to Paul about the Macedonian saints. But according to 2 Corinthians 11, they also bring money. So Paul can devote himself fully to talking and teaching and reasoning with Jews, trying to convert anyone to the gospel of Christ. And that being the case, Paul could devote himself completely to the Word. So we believe that's what's happening at this juncture. All right. Now back in the last half of verse 5, he is concerting his efforts greatly. He's really honing in on teaching the Jews, Luke writes, solemnly testifying to the Jews that Jesus was the Christ. And again, I don't have it on the chart, but other lessons we've had last quarter, those of you who were in there, and this quarter so far, what would have been Paul's primary evidence that Jesus is the Christ? What would he have been using? The prophets. He'd be using the prophecies. Again, because New Testament's not written yet, but he could use passages they were familiar with. As has been the case when Paul was teaching Jews, it's everywhere Paul's been, this happens to him. Not just that they weren't interested, but in large part, how have the Jews normally reacted to Paul's teaching? They've even, on other occasions, they've worked up the city. They've caused mobs and riots. And here, Luke writes in verse 6, when they resisted, not just that, and did what else? They blasphemed. They spoke against what Paul was preaching. So when they did that, Paul gave a rather pointed response to that. Luke says that he shook out his garment. What do you think that means?
Like they did earlier, they shook their sandals off.
Chapter 13, you're right, David. They shook the dust off their shoes in on the first journey. Was that in Pisidia? Antioch of Pisidia, I believe, or Pamphylia? I didn't look at the place, but that's what they did. And they said, you know, you're on your own now. We're going to go to the elsewhere who will give us a fair hearing. And he says, from now on, I shall go to the Gentiles. I've got on the chart also chapter 9 and verse 15. When Saul had his moment in Damascus, after Ananias was instructed to go to Saul, he was Saul at the time. Remember what Jesus told Ananias? He's a chosen vessel of mine. Ananias did not want to go help Paul, Saul, but Jesus convinced him otherwise. He said, I'm going to send him to the Gentiles. So that's always been Paul's mission, was to be the apostle to the Gentiles. Now, Peter was, of course, the apostle to first preach to the Gentiles, but this was Paul's work. And so when he says, I will now turn my focus to the Gentiles, that harkens back to what Jesus said to Ananias about Saul becoming his witness and apostle. Did Saul reach anybody? Well, yes, he did. Look at verse 7. So he departs from where he was, and he goes to whose house? Titus Justus. And where did he live? Right beside the synagogue. Does that mean he was a Jew? I don't know. Luke doesn't say. But he lived... We do know he was a worshiper of God. That's in the verse. Who else does Paul convert? Crispus. Now, who was Crispus? He was the ruler of the synagogue. And in 1 Corinthians 1, 4, verse 14, who does Paul say he baptized? I believe this is that Crispus. So again, see, we're pulling in information from the epistles that harmonizes with the Acts record. That's why this is my favorite part of Acts. And then just in a blanket statement, Luke says, many other Corinthians, hearing, believing, and were what? They were baptized. They obeyed the gospel. So yes, Paul did have results. Paul did convert those in Corinth, despite the fact that the Jews just almost on cue rejected him like they had other places. Paul was somewhat effective, and he did convert some. There in that's through verse 8. Now, in verse 9, Paul is strengthened, and he's reassured by the Lord. Cameron, read for us the Lord's words for us in verses 9 and 10. This is what Jesus says to Paul in a vision at night.
And the Lord said to Paul in the night by vision, do not be afraid any longer, but go on speaking and do not be silent. For I am with you, and no man will attack you in order to harm you, for I have many people in this city.
All right. Well, a lot of good things in these two verses. Let's see if we can pick these out rather quickly. Look in 1 Corinthians 2 and verse 3. Again, we're pulling in more passages from epistles. Paul, when he got to Corinth, look what he writes to the Corinthian Christians. After saying what he says in verse 2 of 1 Corinthians 2, for I determined not to know anything among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. He says, and then I was with you in what state or what frame of mind? What's he say? Fear, weakness and fear and trembling. Now here's the Apostle Paul, who's to me is a hero. He's like Superman almost. But he says, I was with you in weakness and I was afraid and I was trembling. So I believe that's the reason why Jesus comes to him in this vision. Kind of shore him up, give him some courage, give him some strength, some encouragement. So he came to Corinth in that way. And let's not forget again, when he came from Athens to Corinth, he was still alone. And how does one normally feel when he or she is by him or herself, especially in a new place? That's just kind of natural. There's some, I don't want to say anxiety, but there's just some uneasiness when you're in that kind of situation, even for an inspired man like Paul. He still writes, I was with you in weakness and fear and much trembling. So that would have been a natural thing to do. All right. Obviously, he was still worried about the Thessalonians. He had not yet gotten, when he came to Corinth, the report back from Timothy. Timothy hadn't come yet to tell him how they were. So that comes into play in 1 Thessalonians 2 and verse 8. And results in Macedonia had, and I'm summarizing with this statement. I'm not saying that it was all that way, but by and large, it had not been overly successful. I've got here on the chart, chapter 17, verses 4, 12, and 34. Back there real quick. Remember, I had you think about underlining some words in chapter 17. In chapter 17, verse 4, when they were in Thessalonica, how many were persuaded? Some, not many. Now, many is in verse 12, when he was in Berea, because, remember, they were more fair-minded. They were more open-minded to the gospel, so that was a good thing. But then you get down again to the end of chapter 17, after Paul has preached on Mars Hill to those philosophers, and how many were persuaded? Some. Not in droves. And Paul really has enjoyed greater success, and I'm not knocking Paul's efforts. I'm just saying, by and large, Paul has had better success than this. So these, to me, are factors that come into play, kind of give us an insight into Paul's state of mind, how he's thinking, how he's feeling right now. So all these things come into play, and so because of that, the Lord knows everything. The Lord then comes to him in this vision and says, look, Paul, don't be afraid. You keep on speaking. Don't be silent. Don't stop what you're doing. I'm with you. Verse 10, then the statement, and you will not be harmed. You will not be attacked. Had he been attacked before? Yes. Been stoned. Left for dead. He'd been the cause, or been taken out of cities in advance of riots coming. So he had been in some pretty rough spots. And Jesus says, I was going to harm you. Here's the phrase I want to focus on just for a moment. How's this message end in verse 10? What's God say? Or Jesus, rather. I've got what? I've got many, many people in this city. That's always intrigued me when the Lord said that. And that's a teaching point I want to focus on here just in a few minutes. So we'll just stick a pin in that, and we'll come back to that just in a moment. So Paul stayed in Corinth, again, at the house of Titus Justus, in verse 7. How long was he there? A year and a half, 18 months, quite a long time, teaching the Word of God and the Waldrons in their curriculum, and we believe this is so. It is at this juncture where we insert Paul's first two letters. 18 months would have been plenty of time to get report back from Timothy about the Thessalonians, fire off a letter, have it come back, and then again write the second letter. So during this year and a half, this is where we pause in the narrative and insert these two epistles. So that's where we'll end in Acts 18. Now we'll jump over to the Thessalonian letters, and we'll talk about that. But before we do, let's look at this teaching point. When God says, I have many people in this city, these were not yet converts, as I understand it. That's what God's just saying, because again, Paul's not reaching a lot of people, but yet God says, I've got many people. Well, how can God say that? Well, because He's God, and He knows. So, unknowns to us, would it be right to say that God has potential people everywhere? He knows. The Lord knows those who were His. That's in 2 Timothy 2 and verse 19. And passages about providence in both the Old and New Testament. Remember the statement to Ezra? How do you not know that you are where you are? And I'm paraphrasing. At this time, to render service to God. You're in the prime position. And so we just need to trust God. When we may be in situations like Paul found himself in, alone, afraid, in weakness and in fear, and God's got His people out there. It's up to us to get on with God's work and do what we can to help and teach and encourage. And God will take care of the rest. And so I think that's just a great reminder, a great teaching point, that the Lord does have His people everywhere. All right. Now let's spend the rest of our time, about 15, 16 minutes, and we'll get what we can done in the first letter, and then we'll also piggyback that with the second letter. Probably finish it up, the Lord willing, on this coming Sunday. All right, let me first illustrate what I think is an important concept, and I think this can even be communicated to children. And I think it needs to be when you start working in epistles. When we read a New Testament letter, what are we reading? Somebody else's mail, basically. Now, I know the letters were written to us as well, but primarily they're addressed to churches, or, say, in Philemon's case, a specific individual. But we're reading someone else's mail that we're being allowed to, it's been preserved for us and inspired for us, and we need to learn from that and make that our doctrine as well. So let me illustrate this, because children today, they've grown up in a world far, far different than what you and I grew up in. It's just not even the same. Let's discuss the evolution of mail. Probably the closest thing to the first century is the old Pony Express system back in our country in its infancy. So I write a letter in New York, and it went as far west as it could, whether it was Colorado or all the way to California. It took how long to get there? On a horse. Long time. You're snicker, but that's what we're dealing with. Well, mail has evolved, obviously, and now you either have mail delivered by mailman who walks an actual route. My mother still lives in a neighborhood where you have mailboxes on the houses, and the mailman actually walks. But most people have this one. It's the truck that just runs right by your house and just sticks it in the mailbox. So we went from that to this. Then someone got the bright idea, well, let's invent something called express mail. You got to pay for it, but stuff gets there a whole lot quicker. So see how we've progressed. And now what do we have? We have email. You hit a button and it's gone. No paper. It's all electronic. See how mail has evolved. And so if a situation has arisen somewhere that you are aware of and you're on this side of the world and they're over there, when can you communicate to them? Today. Instantly. That wasn't the case of the first century at all. Not at all. And I think we need to help children understand that. The world they're growing up in nowadays is just vastly different than the days of the first century. So we can only imagine the difficulty and infrequency of receiving, of sending and receiving letters in the first century. Paul or other would be inspired to write such and so a message. And think of it this way as well. If the Lord inspired an apostle to write a letter, usually letters were written because there was something or some incident that had happened. It's not like a narrative or a book of history or a book of prophecy. There's some condition somewhere, and God's aware. That's why He inspires a man to write for this reason. These brethren are undergoing this condition or that condition, and so I want you to send a message to address that, either again this person or a whole church. And so when these messages would be sent off, and again carried by a human carrier, they either walked, they rode a wagon, or they got on a boat, and were gone for months. Then the message arrives. And look at 1 Thessalonians 5. We'll look at this passage as well as Colossians 4. Teaches the same thing. 1 Thessalonians 5. I believe that's the right passage. Yes, verse 27. When a church would receive a letter, what would happen? The church would be assembled. And what? It would be read. We're going to hear the letter. And so just imagine, how did the Thessalonians feel about Paul? Just basically. Well, they loved him, and he loved them. They had been through a lot. They had suffered. They were persecuted. Paul as well. And so he's gone, and then he sends Timothy back and forth. Timothy's been there. Timothy comes back and gives Paul a report. So Paul sends a letter. So let's pretend that this little group tonight were the Thessalonian church. That's all there is. It's us, all right? And so word gets back to our city. Guess what? Paul has written us a letter. Wouldn't that thrill you? Wouldn't you want to hear what he said? Absolutely. So the church is meeting tonight, wherever they meet, someone's house, or if they have a rented room somewhere, however that played itself out. And they're going to read Paul's letter to the church. And the statements in that letter would be just exactly on point with things that they knew happened to them in that location. How meaningful would that be? So we need to try to, as best we can, put ourselves in the place of these saints who got these letters and the certain teaching that was in these epistles, and almost live it, if we can, vicariously through them and see how meaningful it was to them. And that's the picture I wanted to paint when we start the epistles. I didn't really do that justice, I know, but it's more than just reading a book. I mean, this is a letter. So, a brief synopsis of 1 Thessalonians. Back in Acts 17, Paul persuades and converts multitudes in Thessalonica. That was the phrase in verses 2 through 4. A great multitude of the God-fearing Greeks and leading women. So, only some Jews, but there was multitudes that were convinced of Paul's teaching. Then jealous Jews caused that riot. We went through all that. Paul and Silas were forced to leave after the riot. That's what happened. Now remember I said last class we want to stick a pin in this. We want to go back to 1 Thessalonians 2, 17 and 18. Paul more than once wanted to return, he says. Look at 1 Thessalonians 2 and verses 17 and 18. Again, this is part of the letter. But he says, let me get over there. But we, brethren, having been bereft of you for a short while, in person but not in spirit, were all more eager with great desire to see your face. For we wanted to come to you, I, Paul, more than once. Yet Satan thwarted us, or Satan hindered us. And I'm asking you to think, now, how did Satan hinder Paul from coming back. What happened in the city after Jason got dragged out of his house because they didn't find Paul? So before things were let go, what did he have to do? He had to pay that bond money. That was a tool of the devil to keep Paul away. And so Paul is in essence, I believe, saying, I would love to come back in the city, but it's going to cause trouble if I show up again for the saints. And I've wanted to more than once to come back, but Satan is thwarting me. Satan is hindering us. See, that's a point that's directly something they would remember and understand. So we don't have to guess. How did Paul feel about them? How did they feel about him? It's right here in the letter. But I wanted to come. I really want to come see you because you're dear to me and I love you. But I can't. So he writes that in the letter. So without doubt, Paul was anxious to hear about how they were doing after his departure. Are they still suffering? Are they still being persecuted? Are they still being physically threatened like again Jason was on that occasion? So in chapter 3 of the letter, he says, and to me this phrase is telling, therefore when we could endure it no longer, we might say in our common day, when I just couldn't stand it anymore, I had to know. So I sent Timothy to find out how you were doing. I just had to know. And Timothy's return and the report he gave to Paul, as we see there in verses 6 through 10, you'll see verse 6, but now that Timothy has come to us from you and has brought us good news of your faith and love, and that you always think kindly of us, longing to see us just as we also long to see you. See, that hits you right where you live. I mean, that just tells you what they thought of each other. For this reason, brethren, in all our distress and affliction, we were comforted about you through your faith. So that report that Timothy gave, we believe was the impetus, was the reason the Lord then inspired Paul to write this letter when he got this reported. So that's the synopsis of the conditions in Thessalonica. Now, again, as I said, I'm going to give you a real brief outline. The one you cover in class when we start the epistles, it may not be anything like this. It's okay. Because there's lots of ways to outline a letter. As long as it gets the main gist of the book, it's okay that it doesn't match this. This is just the one that I've always used. So chapter 1, verses 2 through 10, Paul expresses his thankfulness. I'm going to be going pretty quick through these, so I doubt you'll get all the writing, so you can get these charts online. These are dedicated brethren. He says, I pray for you. I mention you in my prayers. I'm aware of your work. He says, you are, of course, you've been persecuted. Look at verse 6 of chapter 1, when he says, you also became imitators of us and of the Lord, having received the word in much tribulation. Again, when that letter was being read, who would have heard that phrase? And don't just say them. Who specifically? Jason would have heard that. He received the word and he was personally dragged out of his house. There was tribulation. He suffered. He would have heard that. Those in Thessalonica. And look at verses 7 through 10. To me, this is beautiful. You, of course, received the word in much tribulation. But look at verse 7. So that you became an example to all the believers in Macedonia and Achaia. For the word of the Lord has sounded forth from you, not only in Macedonia and Achaia, but also in every place your faith toward God has gone forth, so that we have no need to say anything. What had others heard about the Thessalonian brethren? Paul said, I don't have to brag about you, because they know. Word has gotten, people talk. Even in the first century, people talked. And they were great examples of faithfulness and dedication and steadfastness in the face of tribulation. And so people would say, I'll tell you, those Thessalonian Christians now, they're made of real stuff. They've endured a lot. And Paul's bragging on them. I mean, he really is. He's saying, I'm just so proud of you. If we can use proud in a good way. Usually the scripture doesn't use it in a good way, but Paul was proud of these brethren. He was thankful for them. And he commended them for their faithfulness. So those are the major ideas talked about in chapter 1. Chapter 2, he reminds them again of the circumstances. When he came to them, he mentions his imprisonment at Philippi. That's in verse 2. That's Acts chapter 16. He was opposed by the Jews in Thessalonica. That's in Acts chapter 17. He says, I was not a burden to you. You're very dear to me. I was not burdened when I was with you. He says in verse 13 of chapter 2 that you turn from idols to serve the true God. And they had received the word of God. He says in verse 14, you have become imitators of the churches of God that are in Judea. The Jewish Christians suffered at the hands of the Jews in that place. Well, you're suffering here at the hands of Jews and other Gentiles possibly. So really you're in the same boat as Judean Christians when they were persecuted for their faith. And again, he says, I really wanted to see you. Something's thwarted us. I can't show my face in Thessalonica because it'll just be nothing but problems. And so he mentions that in chapter 2. Chapter 3, he says, I've had to learn how you're presently doing. So he mentions how he's learned of their present condition. He sent Timothy back. We've covered that. He was thankful for Timothy's good report. Timothy said, Paul, they're holding their own. They're really doing, they're holding up under persecution. Their faith is good. They've not fallen away. They've not quit being faithful. And so in verse 11 of chapter 3, Paul says, now may our God and Father himself and Jesus our Lord direct our way to you, and may the Lord cause you to increase and abound in love for one another. So Paul's praying for them. And he mentions that in the letter. So again, if we're the church and we hear that phrase, how would that have made you feel? Apostle Paul's praying for me, praying for us. It's a beautiful sentiment. It really is powerful. And they would even grow stronger in their faith. Now, let me say this. I believe every New Testament letter, maybe I shouldn't say every, almost all of them, follow the same kind of a template. Usually, New Testament letters, the opening section, when you outline it, is more doctrinal. Again, this is the reason why this letter is being written. And the back half of the letter is always application. How you live that doctrine out. And so I believe in chapter 4 we have the application section of the first letter Paul wrote. So general exhortations. I'm praising you for your faithfulness. I'm praising you for your dedication and commitment to the Lord. So here's what I want you to keep doing. Things like this. Refrain from sexual immorality. And again, what went hand in hand with idol worship? Sexual immorality. That was just part and parcel of that. He says, don't defraud and cheat anyone. God avenges all wrongdoings. Live peaceful lives. Be faithful in your secular labors. Behave properly towards unbelievers. They were worried in chapter 4 about their deceased family members who had come to Christ but then had fallen asleep and the Lord hadn't come. So they were worried. Well, what about mom and dad and grandma and grandpa in the ground? Well, what about them? Paul says, look, don't worry about that. God's going to take care of that. So don't let that press your mind. Appreciate those who labor among you and oversee you. Chapter 5, 12 through 13, I believe, speaks about elders and preachers or teachers in the local church. Help the weak. Admonish the unruly. Hold fast to truth. See, these are just real punch list points, exhortations. Do this, do this. Keep doing this, keep doing that. Refrain from this, refrain from that. These are exhortations to faithful living and service. Then final exhortations and requests. Look at chapter 5, 23 through 28. God sanctify and preserve you. That was his prayer for them. Then Paul makes a request. Verse 25, short sentence. What's he say? Pray for me. I mean, again, here's the great apostle. He's written us and he's asking us to pray for him. After all we've been through and all he's been through, he wants us to pray for him. Glad to do it. That would just be a great sentiment. He says, greet the brethren. And then again, verse 27, make sure this letter is read out loud in the local church. I want this read, assemble the church together and have this epistle read. And that's what they would have heard. And this isn't just like reading the newspaper, reading a blog. No, this was a letter from the great apostle Paul. Such a beautiful sentiment. All right, that's real quickly. And again, there's other ways to outline this, but you get the idea. So we'll stop right here. We'll pick up Sunday morning. We'll quickly summarize the second letter. Same kind of a format. So now you know how I'm going to do this with these six journey letters. And then we'll jump back into Acts 18, starting at verse 12. And we'll finish up through verse 22 on the Lord's Day. Thank you for coming to class tonight. I hope to see you on Sunday.